Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. I'm your host, Alan Seals, and this episode is with Donnie Most, who you probably know as Ralph from Happy Days. He can now be seen in a new play called Middletown that was actually in the middle of its run when Broadway shut down, and the producers expertly pivoted, put it online, and now you can stream it through the beginning of April. So please check the show notes right now to make sure that you don't miss your opportunity to watch this, get your tickets, and then when it comes back after COVID, they want to bring it back and start doing it in real life again. So fingers crossed. This guy loves performing. We talk so much about his love for singing, and he goes back to making music and making more songs and doing these amazing old school like jazz standards and crooning standards every chance he gets. You can tell he has a genuine love for the arts, and he was such a pleasure to talk to. Donnie, if you're listening, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Find me online on Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast. I'm on Facebook/official theater podcast. Please leave a rating and a review. And now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Donnie Most.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Today's guest rose to fame as Ralph on Happy Days, but is an incredibly multi-talented individual with an amazing career spanning decades across the stage and screen, with additional credits including The Love Boat, MASH, Glee, EdTV, Star Trek Voyager, Sabrina, Sliders, The Bold and the Beautiful, and Family Guy, one of my favorite episodes. In addition, he's an accomplished singer, producer, director, and writer, and has adapted beautifully to the current times of COVID, starring in a virtual production called Middletown, now available for streaming. Check the show notes for that link. Donnie Most, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you, Alan. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I've heard you referred to, people refer to you online as Don, Donnie, Mr. Most. Yeah. Like, what should I call you today?
Whatever strikes you at the moment is fine. I'll answer to Don or Donnie, even Ralph occasionally.
I was going to say, we'll start with that, but I don't want to start with that. I actually want to go back to the beginning, right? Because we were talking before we started recording about Brooklyn. You grew up in Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn now. And so many great people, yourself included, come out of Brooklyn. Tell me about where you grew up and when did you start thinking about pursuing this, or even what as a hobby, let alone a profession?
Okay. Growing up in Brooklyn, I grew up in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, Ocean Avenue near Church Avenue, just a few blocks from Erasmus Hall High School. And it was a great environment to grow up in. I sometimes feel that it was helpful for me. I think for actors in general, I mean, you need to be able to adapt. You need to be able to, there's such stimuli and stimulus and the energy and all the different types of people, because it really was a melting pot when I grew up there, probably, and it still is, I'm sure. But I think all those things were important. And the kind of childhood that I had, playing ball with my friends. I grew up in an apartment building, and then there was a little court, a street, which was not very heavily traveled. So we would play, punch ball or football, two-hand touch in the street, with the cars parked on either side, and then go down the block to the where the subway station was, there was a wall. We played stickball. And then if you went down a few blocks from there, it was the parade grounds, you know, which had all these great baseball fields, tons of baseball fields, and you'd play there. And then of course, Prospect Park, you know, which was... I think it was a great childhood. And like I talked about, all the different neighborhoods and, you know, ethnicities and Erasmus Hall, we had 8,000 students. So, you know, I mean, you're exposed to a lot, you know? And
wow.
And then I first started, by the way, Barbara Streisand went to Erasmus, and Lainey Kazan and Barbara Stanwyck and a lot of people, Mae West. So, yeah, I think there's something about growing up in those neighborhoods. There's something about it that I think was helpful, maybe stimulated people to want to pursue the business. Now, in response to your question, when did I first start wanting to think of it even as a hobby? Well, I was very young. I was 9 years old, and I saw the movie The Jolson Story, which was the biopic of the great Al Jolson. And I was nine, and I saw that they had Million Dollar Movie back then, which was on Channel 9. And they would pick a movie for a week, and they'd show it twice a night, every night, and then four times Saturday and four times Sunday. So my friend, I was in third grade or something, and he said, "Did you see the movie on Million Dollar Movie last night?" This was Tuesday morning. I remember. And I'd never heard of Jolson. I didn't even know who he's talking about. So I watched it that night, and it had this profound impact on me. I loved it. I loved the talent of Jolson, even though it was Larry Parks playing Jolson, but it was Jolson's voice, and Parks did a great job of capturing Jolson. And the music, you know, I grew up, my mom was a teenager and a young adult during the 40s swinger. So she had a lot of those albums. But then hearing Jolson do it, that kind of music, I became, it was like I was this new birth for me. And I went and got his albums, and I'd go around singing Jolson stuff, you know, in the house, and for my grandparents singing Mammy and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I do plays and stuff, but I didn't really want to admit to people that this is what I wanted to do. You know, like I thought they'd think I was, I don't know. It just seemed that, you know, to be a baseball player, that's what you know, I wanted to be Mickey Mantle too. So that's what I would talk about, but not that I wanted to act and sing. But finally, at the age of 13, when I had my bar mitzvah and I got up with the band and sang Rockabye Your Baby with a Dixie melody, and everyone went nuts. And then everyone said, "Oh, he's got to do something." And then my parents realized this is, you know, what I kind of wanted. Well, at least I had a strong proclivity towards it. And they found me a school in Manhattan that, you know, had kids and teenagers that they would teach for singing, acting, and dancing. So that's when I started really kind of going after it at the age of 13.
13, you started, and then I was reading you get your first big break at 15. So right. Like less than 2 years between starting and getting a big break. Like that's kind of unheard of. There's some people that have been at it for 20 years who haven't gotten a big break yet, more so.
Well, yeah, but I don't know if it was a big break. I mean, to me at the time, it felt like a big break. I got picked from that school. The guy who ran the school would handpick some of the students and create like a nightclub review. He called them the Broadway show-offs. And because his studio was on 1650 Broadway, very famous building. Funny story. It's the same building that, 45 years later, I get a gig to perform we'll get to that later, my singing, my jazz show, at the Iridium Jazz Club, which was based in the same exact spot where I was going to school for Charlie Lowe's studio, where I was going at 13 years old, the same spot. But anyway, I got picked to be in that review. And so I spent the summer, right when I was 14, turning 15, singing in this nightclub act up in the Catskill Mountains resort area, all the hotels that had the nightclubs. So it felt like a big thing for me. I was like 15 years old. Now here I am up there doing, I had three numbers, I remember. And so it was kind of a big break for me at the time. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't know if it really was. But, you know, it led me, it put me on the path. And then I decided to shift my focus more into acting after that summer. I don't know. I think it was because I knew my father kind of thought it was a good idea, you know, to he saw me in perform or do a play somewhere, and he thought it would be good to balance it with some real serious, more of a serious acting class, that kind of thing. So that's what I did after somewhere when I was 15, 16 is when
wow.
I did that.
So that's very aware of your father at that time to realize that, you know, a good performer on stage needs to be able to sing and act, right? Especially if he's not involved with this business at all.
Yeah. When I look back at it, he was very wise about that. And it's not like they were pushing me. I was the one who really, they were just being supportive. But when he saw, I think he also saw that the singing, that particular thing, he knew that was limited, you know, and he was right. I mean, where was I going to, at that age, to do that kind of, you know, maybe the singing would come into play in musical theater. So therefore, you're right. Therefore, he's thinking then I need to round out the acting skills so that the music would come into play there.
Yeah, that was fortunate. Sometimes all it takes is one thing, one teacher, one moment. Kudos to your dad for helping you out with that.
But, absolutely.
So you're going towards this acting route. And then, I mean, I'm looking at your IMDb profile here, and it's like, the first credited thing is as like the equivalent of a Law and Order corpse. I think you were dead body on MASH.
Well, you know, there's a mistake there. People, I guess I should tell IMDb, I was not on MASH. There must have been somebody.
Really? Don?
Or that looked like me. And they, so it's a mistake because other people have said to me, oh, I saw you were on MASH, or I saw you on MASH. And I'm going, no, I was never on MASH. So that wasn't me. So my first real credit on IMDb would have been an episode of either Emergency or Room 222. Because those were the ones I did first when I got to L.A., when I originally came out just for a summer after my junior year in college. I landed those roles. Those were my first two.
Oh, wow. Okay, so junior year of college. So you're 19, right? And because I was reading, you got Happy Days at 20.
Yeah, I was 19 when I first got there. What happened was I still was, so after I enrolled in that workshop, Eleanor Rabb was the teacher, great woman. And I met a manager through her who started working with me. And I got out on mainly because I had red hair, the blue eyes. They thought it'd be great for commercials. So I was getting a lot of auditions for commercials. And then I did like 40 of them from the time I was 16 till I was 20. And, you know, a lot of them were big national commercials. So it was cool. It was a good thing.
That's good money. But
I wanted to do more than, you know, I wanted to act, and I wasn't getting up for too many other things. Theater. I did get up. I came close on a couple of Broadway shows. I was up for the original Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway, and I had like three callbacks. And I thought, okay, you know, then the fourth time, though, I didn't make it through the dance audition is what I think knocked me out of there. But I came close on that, and there was another show I came close on, but I didn't quite get. And they were few and far between those auditions. And I knew that back then, film and TV were mainly being shot in Los Angeles, not New York. Then, you know, soap operas were being shot, and Broadway and commercials. Those were the things that were being done. So for film and TV, I decided, let me go out, spend the summer after my junior year, get some connections and maybe get my feet wet. And then after I graduate, I'll come back here. But what happened was when I got out there for that summer, I had an agent pretty quickly because of the agents that I was working with in New York referred me to some people. And then, so I was lucky several wanted to sign me, and I picked one. And they sent me out on some auditions, and I landed, you know, a couple of parts very quickly. So when I was supposed to go back to college, I actually flew back at the end of the summer. And I wound up talking to my manager at my sister's wedding, said, you know, your agent thinks you have a good shot of, you know, you've got some momentum. So take 6 months off of school and let's see what we can do, because he's got some momentum. So I didn't even think. It was animal instinct. I said, yes, that's what I'm doing. And literally 2 days later, I'm on a plane back to California. You know, I don't know anybody. I met a guy at the summer school at UCLA where I was staying. So I found an apartment in the same complex that he was in. And then, you know, then I did a police story where, although that might have been late, it was very dramatic. I was much more interested in pursuing drama than
really
comedy. Oh, yeah, I was not looking to do comedy at all. Emergency, I played a guy who got paralyzed in a car accident. Then police story, I played a psychopathic mad bomber. But then, and then nothing for like months. And I was 2 months. And then I thought, oh, I made a mistake. But then I got the audition for Happy Days and several callbacks and then a screen test. So that's how that all came about.
So, gosh, I mean, you're skipping over some pivotal stuff that I think a lot of people.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean, it's kind of inconsequential, I think, to you at this point. But you're like, oh, I had a manager when I was in college. I already had a manager from New York. So, you know, we don't need to talk about that. But great, you had a manager. Then you moved to LA, immediately had an agent out there. And then going on these auditions, you only go 2 months without getting work, which, looking back at the last 12 months of Broadway here, 2 months is nothing, right?
Nothing, right?
Yeah. And then all of a sudden land Happy Days. So you're already on this sort of meteoric rise, and then Happy Days hits and you're like straight up, right? Like, what happens at that point?
Yeah. That was certainly a major, you know, kind of like the Twilight Zone is what, you know, your life is totally different. It was an incredibly exciting time. And I should mention that when I got the offer on a Friday night, my agent and I, we decided to turn it down. We passed on it because, as I mentioned earlier, I was more interested in drama.
Yeah.
And I was up for a TV movie that was a dramatic period piece, World War II, with great director, the guy who directed the original Brian song, Buzz Kulik, and the writer who wrote a movie called The Summer of 42, which I loved. So I wanted to do that, and I had a great audition, and my agent said, you have a good chance at this. So when we got the offer for Happy Days on a Friday night, it was like I was much more interested in the drama. So we passed on Happy Days, and I wasn't going to do it. But my agent happened to play basketball every Saturday at Gary Marshall's house.
The guy who created
the show and who's executive producer, and we all know who Gary Marshall is. So Gary took my agent aside during the break in the basketball game and said, what's with your boy turning us down? You know, we'll give him 10 episodes as a guarantee instead of 7. And we'll, instead of $750 an episode, we'll give him $1,000. And he told my agent it had a really good chance of going on the air. So, you know, making it, because you shoot a pilot, 95% of them don't go on the air.
Right.
So my agent said on Monday, maybe we should think about this, you know? So anyway, I did it. And then, yes, it was, everything changed, but it wasn't really, I mean, we became sort of a minor hit in the first year. We didn't become number one until the third season, but still it was a major change in my life, working as a regular on a TV show with one, you know, an amazing cast, great, great people that we all got along incredibly well, not only personally, but professionally. You know, we just respected each other because we took the work pretty seriously, all of them. You know, we worked hard. And it was a lot of talented people working hard to make it look easy. You know, we were kind of dismissed early on. I think they thought we were a bunch of, you know, teenagers or whatever, goofing off, having a good time. But we were very serious about the work. And we had a genius director, Jerry Paris, who did all the old Dick Van Dyke shows. And then Gary Marshall is our top, you know, this top guy. So it was a real tight unit. And we, so it was a great experience. And then when we became really huge, then your life changes dramatically. And they don't teach you an acting class. They should. They have which should have a psychologist running it. You know, how to deal if you happen to, you know, have your life changed from being, you know, basically regular, you know, anonymous in the sense of real sense of the word, and then going to where you can't walk anywhere without people knowing you. And it's not just for a week or 2 weeks or for a month. That's the way it is, you know, for at least the next 10, 15 years, you know? So it was tricky. It's tricky, you know, where you can get sucked into kind of believing the hype and getting, you know, lost. And luckily we had Ron Howard as a role model who had been a star since, you know, he was five. And here he is with this great work ethic, down to earth, really grounded. So you know, him setting an example, and Gary Marshall and Jerry keeping us in check, and Tom Bosley to some a good degree. Here he was; he had won the Tony on Broadway for Fiorello, and you know, and he was a star to some pretty good degree. So we had a lot of people to mentor us and keep us. And like I said, Ron being a tremendous example, so that helped. Otherwise, you know, you can go down the wrong path, you know, when you get seduced by all the things that go along with that kind of crazy fame.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, I was going to bring up being in a nightclub scene when you're 15, right? So, you know, you're being around there, I'm sure had its own string of adventures, but then going to this place and being that well known before social media, like that right. was what was so impressive about this time, I think. Part of what was so impressive is that if you're that famous and you don't have an Instagram account, there's no Facebook, there's no TikTok, right. there's nothing, right? Right? Like everyone just knows you. And that's gotta be so crazy. And I've got a friend who's a PA for a big celebrity, and you know, she's saying like they need PAs, personal assistants, because you know, you can't go get a Starbucks without getting mobbed. And it messes with your psyche. Like, you seem like an outgoing guy. You seem like you're very friendly, but there's at some point when you realize like everybody talking to me probably wants something. Like, does that mess with you?
Oh yes, definitely. Yeah. Because you don't know where they're coming from, you know, and what, and you start to, you know, doubt that, you know, that any of these people might be interested in you otherwise, or want to talk to you, or not, at least not to the degree that they want to, and that everyone wants to be your friend. And so you can create like a cocoon, you know, you can get where you put up a defense mechanism and you go too far the other way, you know, it could do that as well. And in many other ways that, you know, it could affect you, because then you kind of lose touch with reality a little bit. I remember at one point it really hit me, and I was in the house that I had bought, you know, still pretty young, and I bought this really nice house, and it just hit me that I was losing touch with, you know, the value of money and regular things. Luckily, I was 20 when I started doing the show. I already was kind of a young adult, gone through 3 years of college, had a solid family background and support. So that helped a lot. Otherwise, like I said, it does mess with you. And I wound up seeing a psychologist for, you know, to go into have some therapy sessions, because that's what I was saying. They should have that in acting classes, you know, the one class where, just in case this happens, you know, although it probably wouldn't be sufficient, you know, one class probably wouldn't do it. But yes, it's a tricky road to navigate.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Then when it's gone, right? And I'm gonna, you know, we're shifting right into Middletown and we're shifting into the theater and the singing now.
Right.
Then you've got all this, all these accolades and all this attention and all this money coming in and everything. And then the show stops. And,
right. Well, I left the show 4 years before it ended.
Yeah.
So it stopped for me at that point. Okay. So it's still a stop. Yeah. I left it because I felt I needed to try to, you know, I was playing one character for 7 years and I wanted to break away from that, which was very difficult back then when you only had three networks, you have 50 million people watching you, 60 as opposed to, you know, 5 million. So yes, it was very, and I made it even harder on myself because I told my agents, I don't want to do television for a while. Mm-hmm. I just want to try to do film and theater. And back then it was almost impossible to go from a sitcom to film. And I found, you know, a handful of people were able to make a successful transition into that, you know, Travolta and Tom Hanks. And that's, you know, back for those, that's about it. Sally Field, maybe.
Yeah.
So it was very, but I was 27 and I, you know, I just felt it's time to try, at least make the attempt. So I go the next 6 months with a big agency. I couldn't even get an audition to come in and try out for a film.
Wow.
You know, because I couldn't even audition for I went 6 months, maybe longer. You know, I finally got one audition, but it was more like an interview. So it was like hitting a brick wall in that regard. And I didn't do, so I did theater, you know, to keep my sanity. I was doing plays in different parts of the country that I was able to get because of the notoriety was good for that. But then, so that helped. But, and then I finally said to my agent, let's do some television, you know, I'll do television because I needed to work, you know,
yeah.
I needed to work. And so, you know, and I wasn't getting the parts that I really, the kinds of roles that I really wanted to get up for and try out for and do, but I figured I have to do it and peck away at that, you know, the concrete or brick wall in front of me and start chipping away at it. And that's what I did. I kept, you know, plugging away at that. And gradually it opened up more and more. And especially as I got into an older, you know, now I'm at an age where I think that people can accept me in a very different kind of role. And there's more separation, time and distance from Happy Days. So it's making it. So I'm now there's some really cool roles have been coming my way and, you know, some very interesting roles, dramatic, some comedy and drama and all different. I have a movie out on Amazon Prime now called Lost Heart, mm-hmm. where I play a local pastor in a small town in northwestern Michigan. And the town is called Lost Heart. And then MBF is a film on Amazon Prime as well that I did right before that. A very powerful, dramatic film. I play a defense attorney defending a wounded vet. So, you know, these are all, it was like now, yes, roles are starting to come and, you know, and interesting plays. I did the play Art about a year and a half ago. Great play. Won the Tony on Broadway years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to do that. And Sunshine Boys, I did with Robert Wall. And I just got cast. I'm heading to New Mexico next month to do a Lifetime movie and then to Prague to do a film where I'm going to play a king. And it's sort of a Princess Bride kind of film, you know? So, it's, you know, and then theater, of course, Middletown, which I was doing, I mentioned a couple of plays, but then right before the pandemic, we were doing Middletown, which was an absolute joy for me to do. And then we were doing, at that time, we were in Chicago. I was supposed to be there for a month. And around the second, third week, we had to close down
right, when
all the theaters were shutting down. And we were in Atlanta before that. And it had been in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and Las Vegas. And we had others lined up. You know, it's it's an original play and very unique. And I'll let you sort of segue into that if you'd like, or if I haven't quite finished something else, we can do that too.
No, well, actually, it's a good place for it. Yeah. So Middletown, it's a 4-person show. You're starring alongside Didi Khan, who of course is Frenchie from Greece, Sandy Duncan, who's Peter from Peter Pan, Adrian Zemed, who's Romano, and T.G. Hooker. Like the cast of this is alone. I wanted to see all of you. I think it's going to be magic to work to see all four of you together. But so you were.
I think it was. I would concur with that. At least that's how the audience seemed to feel too. It really was kind of a magical ensemble.
So was it? When was the decision made to film it for streaming?
Well, what happened was they weren't. It was good foresight, but you know, nobody had that crystal ball. But when we were at the theater in near Atlanta, I remember one day Seth Greenleaf, who's the director of the show and his company produced it, G4 Productions, told us that they were going to be filming, you know, for one or two performances, and they said just to have it. For archival purposes, I guess, you know, you like to have a record of it and, you know, it wasn't going to be used for commercial reasons. That was the intent. That was the reason they shot it. Luckily they did, because then, you know, when the pandemic hit, you know, I don't know, several months later, I can't remember the timing, they got in touch with us and said, you know, because everybody was figuring out what to do, and they figured out, maybe we could have a life for this play right now as a streaming entity. So they talked to us about it, and we all, you know, agreed on how it could be done, and that's how it happened. So luckily they shot it. Good thing they did.
Well, that's amazing. So it was just coincidental. Now it's out there. Yeah. It's let's see. I'm gonna look at my notes here. It's streaming now as this episode airs, and it's gonna streaming sales end April 4th. So make sure you get it before the 4th of April. But I'm fascinated with how the industry, TV and film and theater, TV and film has come back much quicker than theater, because theater, of course, requires an in-person audience.
Right.
But all of this stuff that's happened during lockdown and COVID and this pandemic, it's been absolutely insane. And some people have completely disengaged. Some people have doubled down. They're busier now than they were beforehand.
I know.
So crazy. Like for you though, so you're in the middle of Middletown when lockdown happens, and then I guess everything is an unknown at that point. So what's going through your mind?
Wow, yeah, I'm trying to remember what my psyche, you know, what was going on in my mind at the time. I mean, I was disappointed, obviously, because I wanted to continue doing the play, and we had other cities lined up. But then to some degree, you know, it was okay to just relax a little bit. Now, the other thing that was going on was I was in the middle of recording a CD, you know, for my singing. Mm-hmm. I had one out 2 years prior called Mostly Swinging, doing all the jazz standards with a great big band. But then I was in the middle of doing a new one with a producer in Nashville, where we were doing a little different, more contemporary jazz kind of feel and some stuff from the 60s and 70s. So we were about 3/4 of the way done. I was supposed to go back to Nashville right after Middletown to finish the CD. And we couldn't. So I was, you know, frustrated. But I took some time to just kind of relax and spend time with my wife. And that was fine for a while. But then you start getting nuts. You know, you start going, well, what am I going to do? And Now, creatively, it was good because I was able to work on my music at home because on my computer I can do it. Mm-hmm. So I was working on that and trying different songs to see what we're going to finish the CD with. And then I started, and also I've developed, you know, I've directed 3 independent features. And so I was developing some new projects. So I was working on that. And with my wife, we had 2 that we were working on together. 1 film script, and we got producers that really liked it and wanted to try to get it made, and we were doing rewrites based on their notes. So we were doing stuff like that, and then a TV series that we were working on together as well, based on her stuff going on in her life. She's got Parkinson's disease, and she came up with a great blog, and we adapted it into a series. So we were working on that sort of thing, and then. A producer friend called me who I had worked with about 5 years prior, 7 years, and said the same guy who wrote the pilot that we had done 5 years ago, they were thinking of doing something that we could do now. He said, hey, we all want to be creative and productive. Here, what do you think about this? It would be a series called Viral Vignettes, and it would be like maybe 8-9 minutes, 10 minutes, little pieces, short, like a scene, you know. And it would be 2 actors, and he knew a bunch of other actors he had worked with, so they'd be people that would be recognizable. And he said, and they'll be, each one will be scripted, and you could act in some, direct some, whatever you know, or both. And I said, well, that sounds like a cool idea, because so the idea would be that there's 2 people doing it from like we're doing right now. I mean, you know, like a video chat or something. So 1 actor is in his house, the other's in the other, and the script is, supports that. You know, the first one I did was with, it was a cousin of mine, supposedly, that we hadn't seen each other and we still couldn't see each other. So we're getting back in touch, you know, on Skype or something like that. Right, and then it was a scene. So I brought in Robert Wool, who I had done the Sunshine Boys with, and we played cousins. It was called Old Buddies. And it was a funny, you know, 10 minutes or whatever. And we shot it and it came out great. And then I wound up acting in another one with Gail O'Grady, playing the same character, but now I'm talking to my therapist. She's my therapist. and I'm like having a real thing for my therapist. So that was that one. And then, you know, and there's all different ones. A lot of, and then I directed one with Linda Pearl and Lydia Cornell and Anson Williams, my great friend from Happy Days. He directed one. And there were a lot of other actors. So people could go on YouTube and check it out. It's called Viral Vignettes, and check them out. They're really good. So that was a great thing to do that worked for the times, you know, that we were with the restrictions that we were all limited with.
That's amazing. I really enjoy that. And there's been so many scripts. Like now that a year has gone by, there have been so many scripts that have been written specifically for the Zoom platform that involve breakout rooms, right? So I actually went, I attended a virtual show the other night where you go into the room and you all start out together. And then depending on if you're on the alpha team or the beta team, it was a sci-fi thing. And like we had to go off into different breakout rooms in Zoom. And then there was a voting platform. So we actually, it was kind of choose your own adventure interactive thing.
Oh my God.
And I did it right here from my office. And it was interesting. Like Zoom is not made for a performance aspect because as an audience member, it's weird for me to be like, you know, right up in someone's face, because when you're on stage, when you go see a stage production, it's all about the ambiance and the shared experience and the lights and the subtlety of that sort of thing. So for me, I'm not a fan of staring at somebody and having a static shot the whole time. So I think that's a problem that needs to be overcome. But in terms of like talking about podcasting, what we're on now, radio plays are my new thing. I love a good radio play when it's written as a radio play, because you can get all of these great sound effects, and then, you know, you can manipulate the microphone and get the voice all up on. Yeah. So there's all these things you can do that are so much fun. And I really enjoy it.
That would be fun already. a radio play. I'd like to do that. That would be fun.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to your singing though, because we've mentioned that, and
then we should just talk. I want to tell people a little bit about Middletown, what it is, and all that.
Oh, well, before we go to singing, then let's continue with Middletown, because yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. Because you mentioned, you know, there's Dee Dee Khan, who actually her first job in L.A. was a guest role on Happy Days. She played my girlfriend.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was great when I found that I was going to be working with Dee Dee in Middletown. She's so fabulous. She's great. And then Sandy Duncan, who I'd never worked with, but of course I had seen her work and knew of her, and she's just amazing to work with. And Adrian Zemed, I'd never worked with, but we had played on the same sort of entertainment league softball, you know, softball kind of. And
that's where you make your best friends sometimes.
Yeah. So we knew each other for a long time from that. And so it is a great cast. And it's a very interesting piece because it's done in a very minimalist kind of style. There's four music stands on stage and four chairs, and the scripts are on each stand. So we're up there, but then Sandy's character, Peg, is sort of serves as the narrator. So she's talking to the audience and then introduces us. And then we get into the story. It's written by Dan Clancy. It's a fabulous play. Two couples that live in Middletown, New Jersey. And you know, they've been friends for 33 years. And they have dinner every Friday night together, you know, restaurant or wherever. And you go through their lives. You know, it goes back to when they first met and how they met, the wives met, you know, at school because their kids were at school. And you go through their lives to get all the ups and downs, like they call it the ride of your life. It's a real roller coaster. You know, all the things that happen when you're raising kids and then they get married and jobs, stuff going on at work and problems with marriage and then deaths. And, you know, it's a wonderful combination of that, of life in terms of the comedy and the drama. And it's done in such a, because of the storytelling and the purity of it, it works way better than I ever expected, you know, because I'd never done a play like that. And I didn't know if it would have the reach that a play that has all the bells and whistles and where you're doing it, you know, in a conventional way with this great scenery or the sets and the lighting. But this is just pure storytelling, but it takes on this other life and people are crying, they're laughing and they're crying. And oh my, the reactions were amazing, just amazing. So, that's why it was such a joy doing this play. And I'm looking forward to things opening up so we can get back and do it. But in the meantime, people can check it out on that platform, Overture, which I don't have the exact address. But
I'll put it in the show notes for the podcast here. Yeah.
So people could check it out. Because I've heard from some people who have seen it in this format, streaming, and they just, it's because I haven't watched it. I don't know if I was a little leery to thinking, how did they capture it? Did they have enough cameras? And, you know, I was like a little leery to see it, but I've seen some great response where they were saying it was just incredibly moving and the performances were fantastic. And yeah, we are, it is a great team and we really gelled wonderfully together. So I encourage people to check it out.
So are there plans that have been disclosed to you yet for it to start running again in a stage somewhere?
Nothing specific. I mean, there were some that were set up prior, pre-COVID. I can't even remember the cities right now. But I'm hoping those will be rescheduled and then, of course, new additional ones added to it. And so we can go all around doing it. Who knows, maybe wind up in New York, it would be great. You know, it'd be kind of cool. As there's been some talk, maybe off Broadway, it could work in an off Broadway kind of setting. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, hopefully, it'll bring you back to Brooklyn, I guess.
Yeah, I would love to come back and be up on the boards in New York. I would love that.
Okay, so singing. That was the credit. Researching for this, that I was most surprised to learn about because knowing, you know, you've got a TV and film career, and I'll take that back, because you do have lots of theater credits, but given what's the, you know, the first connotation is TV and film, which is not a singing right. sort of platform. So, right. but you're actually an incredible singer. And
when you
said you were up for the final cast of the OC of Jesus Christ Superstar, I wanted to come back to that because your style is like, you're a crooning like a Frank Sinatra's, like a right. sort of thing,
yeah.
which doesn't fit Jesus right. Christ Superstar.
Right, right. Well, the thing is, maybe that's why, you know, I didn't maybe have quite enough of that legit voice, as they call it. You know, I mean, I tried to sing it. I didn't, on those auditions, I remember, I had to sing songs from the play itself. So I had to sing them the way that would be appropriate. And I did pretty well. Like, you know, I got through three auditions, and I wound up doing the play Damn Yankees on tour with Dick Van Dyke, mm-hmm. and I played Joe Hardy, and I had to do that. And then I did the play I Love My Wife, which was a musical. I had a lot of singing in that, but they had different styles. But yes, my wheelhouse, the music that I have is in my blood, the passion, is those great standards done with a jazz feel, swing. Doesn't only have to be swinging, you know, ballads, but with a jazz, I love the jazz and blues kind of approach to this kind of that kind of music, you know. That, and although I'm starting to play with some other styles, I have a single that's being released, was released in the UK. For some reason, we're releasing it there first because we haven't finished the CD yet. and I did a song that was originally done by Smokey Robinson in 1965 called Ooh Baby Baby, a real Motown R&B thing. But we did it with a little jazz and R&B. So I'm having fun trying some new styles. But yeah, when I get up there with a big band, or, you know, even if it's a 7-piece, 10-piece, and have those great arrangements and doing, like you said, sort of the Sinatra kind of material. I was a huge Bobby Darin fan who could do that music as good as any of them. I saw him at the Copacabana when I was 18, and he could swing and do jazz and blues and folk and anything, but he could do that kind of, you know, that Sinatra kind of thing so wonderfully. So I loved all that. Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald, all those great singers of the standards. So I'm in my house, in my territory, when I'm up with a band doing that kind of music.
And you do big band stuff, but you've also directed multiple things. The last Best Sunday was your directorial debut in 1999. Yeah. So I mean, you mentioned writing, all these other things. If you had to pick one thing now. I was going to say, if you could only pick one thing, what would you do? But
right.
I think there's multiple sides of this. So there's, I guess the first question is, what out of everything have you enjoyed the most? But then moving forward, what would you like to right. do that you haven't done yet?
Yeah, boy, that's okay. That's a tough one. What I've enjoyed when I'm doing, okay, on the film TV side, when the material is something that you really love, you know, because if I'm doing music, I'm picking the greatest songs, you know, the greatest material that I'm picking, and I'm helping to figure out the arrangements. So it's not apples to apples, because most of the time when you're acting, you know, you don't get to pick only the best material. You're lucky if the greatest material comes your way. So, but I've tasted doing, you know, material that I've loved, that I really think is well, beautifully written, and it's being done with other great people. So then I love that as much as when I'm singing some of this great stuff. But sometimes you are acting in pieces that, you know, the material's pretty good, it's not great, or it's really good, but it's still not, you know what I mean? So it's hard to compare. Now, when I've done theater, it's usually some of these pieces were fabulous, you know, so then I love that too. So it's really about when the material is great, whatever it is, mm-hmm. that's what I love. So now moving forward, I feel there's so much more I want to do that I haven't done yet on film as an actor, whether it be film or TV. So I'd say that's what I really, I think my focus would be on that more than anything. Of course, a great play. I love the live theater experience, and I want to do more. But if you told me what I really want to do, ask me, it would be, you know, some great roles ahead of for me in film and TV. That's, you know, I want the music. I have to do, and I will hopefully, and theater. But I would zero in more on film right now. Why? I don't know. I guess if it's great material and you're working with great people, I love the fact that you could capture it in a way that is there forever, and that has been transferred onto the screen in a beautiful way. If it's all coming together, you know, with the cinematography, the acting, the storytelling, the cinematography, the music, and it could be, you know, there forever. That's very attractive to me.
I love the idea of writing, directing, and starring in something because it's your vision.
Yeah,
right? Like you don't have the layers of abstraction of somebody else's vision or directorial style or even their writing style. Like, you know, it's one of the most straight pen to screen sort of processes that way.
Yeah. I just don't know that I'm a good enough writer that would create that great vehicle for myself. You know, I've done some writing working with other people. You know, I can't write by myself, working with other people. But so if I had a great script that had a great part for me, I could take that on, you know, because I'm directing. I love that idea. But for me to write it and star and direct, I don't know if the material would be as good as I want. I don't think I can do it as a writer.
Fair enough. Okay, so we can wrap up this episode here with the three standard closing questions that I ask everybody to end the episodes here. So the first one is, very simply, what motivates you?
Excellence.
Good. All right. Second question then, what advice would you give to your younger self or younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
My younger self or younger people?
Both. It could be two different answers.
Those are different. Okay. Those are different. For younger people who are considering this kind of a path, is that what you mean?
Yes.
I'd say you better love it and want to do it more than anything, and you can't think of doing anything else. Otherwise, don't bother. I do it as a hobby, but not as a career, as you alluded to earlier, because of how crazy, unfair, and ridiculous it can be. So if you love it and that's it, and that's all you're going to think about doing, then pursue it, get into a good class, good classes, and dive in. But otherwise, do it as a hobby. Now, for my younger self, somebody asked me this, the same thing, advice. It's tough because, you know, having the knowledge of all those years and telling somebody younger, are they going to even understand it really? You know, because, you know, it's probably the typical things of really appreciating, being grateful for, you know, the achievements that you're having at the time, and don't judge them in terms of comparing it to other. That's the biggest advice, I guess, comparing it to where other people have gone, you know, because it could be a never-ending thing. I could be, you get on a hit show like I did, but then I'm wanting to do movies, you know, I want to do those Academy Award movies. I mean, it'll never end, because then I mean, that's sort of like an endless loop that could go on forever. So I guess the advice would be, you know, to not to be judging it and comparing it, and just taking it in and being grateful and moving forward with that.
I love that. That's beautiful. Okay, so the last question. This is the hardest one. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Are we talking about a TV show, a theatrical show?
Interpret any way you wish.
Wow. One show, and that's the only thing I could watch. I know there's a great answer in there for me. I have to, you know, give me a minute or two to think about what that would be. Wow. Oh, man. You know, one that I just like would watch over and over and not get tired of. I might come up empty for you. Has anybody just said, you know, I can't answer that?
No, people, the most provided answer in the theater space is Sweeney Todd.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I mean, there's so many plays that I haven't seen, you know, being out here, I haven't been to New York and I've missed a lot of great, great shows. So,
well, what's your favorite movie then? Do you have a favorite?
Well, it was probably, it might just be The Wizard of Oz. I might have to go with The Wizard of Oz.
Okay, we can go with that. And are you on social media?
I am. I'm on Facebook as Don Most, and on Twitter, it's @most_Don. And then on Instagram, it's Don Most 1.
Because Don Most Original took your name. All right. Well, you are the original. We should get them to give you their account.
I could have said original, huh? I didn't even know that.
Wonderful, wonderful. All right. You can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook on theater_podcast. Leave a rating, leave a review wherever you are listening. This has been edited by Matthew Hendershot. Thank you to Jukebox the Ghost for the intro and outro music. And Don Most, thank you most of all. This has been incredible.
Oh, thanks, Alan. I enjoyed chatting with you and delving into all this. It was really good. Thank you.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.